From the studios of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. There's growing community frustration in Tumutu province of Solomon Islands over bauxite mining operations. The Australian mining company AU Capital Mining, co-owned by Pacific Bauxite, in 2015 won a license to prospect for bauxite at the Nanindi Tumutu. The bauxite interests are being linked with recent political turmoil in the province, as Johnny Blades reports.
Tumutu's former provincial premier claims his recent removal was all about approving licenses for mining and logging interests. Tellingly, Nelson Omar had rejected Pacific Bauxite for a business license.
The consent from the resource owners, the landowners, how it was conducted was not done in accordance to the existing legislations that govern the mining and logging practices.
Pacific Bauxite has not responded to RNZI's questions, but on its website the company insists it has consulted with locals.
The company is extensively engaged with the local community and is ensuring that all stakeholders are made fully aware of current and future activities regarding the project. To this end, meetings held with local parties to date have been extremely positive, and much enthusiasm has been generated by the recent phase of exploration.
The company was still without a business license in late March when the Tumutu Provincial Assembly voted in a new premier, David Miner. It coincided with a flurry of activity on the Australian Stock Exchange as people bought up shares in Pacific Bauxite. Nelson Omar says he warned the Assembly in advance that the basis for moves to oust him was to approve a business license for Pacific Bauxite.
In fact, it did happen. Days after the closure of the assembly, the license was granted in an urgent executive meeting, exactly as I have predicted.
Grace Carver is from the west side of Tumutu's capital, Lata. She says most people do not approve of bauxite mining in Tumutu, given the environmental impact from mining in a neighbouring province.
Because they already knew something like the bauxite mining happened in Wendat province. After all, they get into a big disaster. This means that the same thing will happen to them.
Another local person from Gracious Bay, Ben Menevi, says mining threatens the environment which the community relies on for its water source.
So that's my concern, that if the bauxite continues, you come and then do the work, then they might destroy some of the topsoils at the top of the mountain where the water source came from.
The director of mines, Thomas Toba, says mines officials considered numerous objections to mining before granting the company a prospecting license. Mr. Toba, who admits that their consultations were restricted to discussions with Honiara-based people, says officials from his department now plan to go to remote Tumutu to listen to the local community.
We are definitely going down to listen to them, probably next week, just to get the views. If they have a majority rejecting this project, then we can look at the means to discuss with the company and also how we can resolve this problem.
Meanwhile, the Australian mining company is reportedly due in Tumutu this month for the signing of documents before the commencement of prospecting. If Facebook discussions about bauxite mining in Tumutu are any indication, the company might encounter a heated reception from landowners. This is Johnny Blades.
The arrival of a New Zealand fishing vessel in Fiji is being hailed as a boost to fight against illegal fishing across the South Pacific. The ship arrived in Sava Harbour this past week to help with patrol Fiji's executive economic zone and territorial waters and help train its own navy. It's the first time one of New Zealand's Navy inshore patrol vessels has been deployed in the South Pacific. CEO of the Fiji Fishing Market Group, Daryl Hodgson, told Tom Glasgow, this has been the best option, and he hopes that things will improve the Fiji fishing industry.
What we've been told and what we've sort of seen in the media in Fiji and around, basically they're here to assist the Fiji Navy in controlling illegal IUU fishing vessels in the Fiji waters. And I guess, not just in Fiji, but I guess this one's based in Fiji from the understanding that we've been told. But there's a number of vessels fishing the high seas and fishing the Fiji boundaries. And I guess you've heard about the blue boats.
Yes.
Down as, as low as Umea, and that's, you know, that's a long way for them to travel such a small boat. But you know, I've picked a lot of them up in the Solomons lately. And from our point of view, from Fiji Fishers' point of view, it's 100% locally owned fishing company and 8 boats out fishing, and we fish within the EZ, and you know, inside and outside limits, we can sort of fish anywhere. And you know, the fish stocks are just so low, and fishing itself's been so hard, even for the some of the contract vessels that we have that are frozen vessels that are fishing, not so much in Fiji waters, but in the southwestern Pacific. I mean, it's quite shocking the amount of vessels that are fishing around on the borders and slowly creeping into areas where they're not supposed to be fishing, and then places like Fiji just can't afford to fund. Or have, you know, to try and track these vessels down and get them out of the area.
How bad is the issue becoming in Fijian waters, and how much of an impact is it having on the industry?
It is very bad. There hasn't been so many caught fishing in our waters because, unfortunately, the Fijian Navy's put 2 of their boats on the reef within the last 12 months. The third boat, which has gone back to Australia, I think it's gone to Australia for rebuild. You know, they just haven't really managed their resources or their, you know, trained their people properly to sort of look after the vessels, I guess. My understanding as far as New Zealand coming here too was to help with some training and get these guys up to speed also, not just sort of cruise around and pick up illegal boats, but also to help with some of the other fallen downside of the issues with the Fiji Navy. So I think overall it's a great thing. There's so many Chinese boats fishing on our boundaries right now, on the high sea boundaries. It's ridiculous. And their gear's floating through and floating over, you know, into Fiji waters. About 12 to 14 years ago, Fiji used to harvest 15,000 tonnes of fish per annum. Going back sort of 5 years ago, they reduced that down to 13,000 metric tonnes. You know, when you look at it on a scale basis, each vessel needs to catch 250 tonnes of fish per vessel to actually break even. There's no profit in that. That's an average size vessel fishing in Fiji. Now, they haven't harvested any more than 6,000 tonnes in the last 2 years. Quite honestly, our boats, they haven't made any money for many years. We do other things to subsidise, to keep fishing and keep the locals employed.
How much support has the Fijian Navy given the fishing industry, and how much protection have you had up until now?
We have had a little bit, to be honest. When I say a little bit, you know, they have been out and around. I think it's a whole training thing with them too, is that they're not, I guess they're not really focusing on what they really are here for. I think that's part of the problem, and I think that now the Kiwis are actually making a bit of a stand and coming out to try and help in this area. Obviously, it'll be a spin-off to other areas. So whatever happens here in Fiji, all those illegal fishing boats will soon know what is going on here. I'm sure you'll find they will stop wherever they're doing it, everywhere else in the South Pacific. As a start point to start in Fiji and stay in Fiji for X amount of time, it's only got to be a good thing for the rest of the South Pacific.
So it's sort of a statement.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's the best thing that's ever happened to the fishing industry. Anyway, we have had a couple of Ryan flying around Fiji. I don't know if they're still doing it, but a couple of my captains came back and said that they were fishing quite right up in the top end, the north end of Fiji, and they had an Orion buzz them twice up there. They were taking photos and keeping an eye on and reporting back on our boats, and that was about 12 months ago. They are looking at different times, but you know, this will be certainly a great opportunity to catch and get rid of a lot of the illegal guys in the area, that's for sure. Keep the ones out that are thinking of coming this way.
It shows a bit of a, you know, easing of the kind of relationship between the two countries too.
Just sort of hear, oh, the Kiwis are coming, you know, the Kiwis are coming up to help us, and you know, it's a wonderful thing.
The Fiji government has moved to allied fears that a new bill aimed at preventing criticism of MPs, if enacted, Clause 24 of the Parliamentary Powers and Privileges Bill, would impose penalties for defaming, demeaning, or undermining the sanctuary of Parliament. Ben Robinson Drawbridge reports.
Critics of Clause 24 include the lawyer Richard Naidu, who says there's no legal equivalent in any democratic country. He says the words demean and undermine are not defined by law, and sanctity doesn't apply.
I certainly certainly haven't found any provision in the Commonwealth or in any country that calls itself a democracy that has a similar provision to Clause 24. We're not allowed to undermine or demean the sanctity of Parliament. I don't think I've ever heard parliamentarians being described as a collective group of saints, but there you have it.
A professor with the School of Government at the University of the South Pacific, Vijay Naidu, says there's already law to prevent the defamation of parliamentarians. He says if Clause 24 is enacted, democracy in Fiji will be stifled.
They seem to attribute qualities to institutions that actually should be under scrutiny all the time and be the subject of public debate and discussion. The parliament is a public institution and therefore should be subject to the scrutiny of the general public.
Clause 24 proposes fines and imprisonment for individuals, companies and their directors of up to 5 years. The leader of the National Federation Opposition Party, Biman Prasad, says the clause is a threat to free speech.
It's all about people and the ability to elect representatives to Parliament, and therefore they have the right to have an opinion about what parliamentarians or the elected representatives do in and outside Parliament. And we believe that the essence of democracy will be removed if you are doing anything to restrict the public's right to criticise the elected representatives.
But the chair of the standing committee considering the bill, the MP Ashneel Sudhakar, says Clause 24 protects the institution of Parliament and not the government.
People who are criticising the clause, they are reading words into that clause and saying that it is preventing or dragging the people from criticising MPs and the government. If you read the Clause 24, nowhere does it state that. The institution of Parliament, the Speaker and the Committee, that's all that that clause mentions. Everybody has the right to criticise the government and its policies if they feel they need to do so.
Ashneel Sudhakar says existing defamation law in Fiji only shields individuals and, like the courts, Parliament needs legal protection from slander. But the lawyer Richard Naidu says Clause 24 could silence dissenting voices.
Obviously the very first effect of it will be simply to chill any criticism of Parliament. That's already the case with laws like the media decree. And so you have these wide, virtually meaningless provisions that aren't really capable of easy definition in the law, which sit there like a sort of sword of Damocles just waiting to drop on anybody who the government thinks offends them. So, of course, the result is that people just prefer to stay silent and not take the risk.
Written submissions on the bill will be accepted until May the 15th. This has been Robinson Drawbridge.
Provisional election results in Niue indicate a boost to women's representation in Niue's parliament. At least four women have won a place in the 20-seat legislature, that is, after the country went to the polls on Saturday. Olav Jacobsen was one of the two women who gained one of the six common roll seats, and a fifth woman is in tie for a village seat. A journalist with the Broadcasting Corporation of Niue, Ina Vakafi, told Sally Round the voter turnout was good, especially in the larger constituencies.
11 village seats were contested, and 8 members retained their seats. There are 3 new ones. One is actually undecided. So for the village of Hakupu, they have now voted in Michael Jackson in place of young Vivian. And Michael isn't new. He has contested before, and he's also a former Common Role member, so he won't be new to the Legislative Assembly. Mona Inu contested in the last election for the village of Tuapa, and this time round she's been successful. There were 4 candidates for Tuapa, and it's good to see that the 23 who voted for her before, I mean, she maintained that number, and then the rest of the votes were divided by the other 3 candidates. For Mutalau, there was a tie between Maxel Ioane and Maureen Malikitama, so we will have to wait and see the recount, and if it remains at a tie, then it will need to draw from the hat. So those were some of the surprises. In the common role, one from the previous 6, he lost a seat. That was Tongia Stoniholo, and he's been replaced by Olav Jacobson, and she had only just returned home, but she's also has experience. She's been in the common role before, and this time around she topped at number one. But in terms of changes, especially at common role, it seems like the island still prefers, you know, those who were in the common role previously.
So preferring to stick with what they know rather than going for any of those new faces?
Yes, because there were so many new faces and there was so much potential in some of the... But because there's so many names to choose from, those votes end up being split out. There was a saying earlier this week that people are voting with their heart and not their head. The community ties, the family ties, and that all comes into play when elections.
That tie is between a man and a woman. If she gets in, that could be an unprecedented 5 women in the 20-seat legislature. So a quarter of the legislature, potentially women. What's been the reaction to that?
It's very hard to gauge right now what the reaction is. Throughout this week ahead, I'm sure that people will have more time to give comment about what they think or how they think the elections went. Because each time when we talk about wanting change, I'm not sure what kind of change, because we seem to see the same people come out on top when it was the votes. Maybe with more women in there could be a shift, and that's what we're looking for. Now it's going to be a numbers game where those who would like to go for the premiership would need to rally up the numbers, start lobbying, and I'm sure lobbying would have started from last night until it's time to select a speaker and then find out who will be the next premier.
How many are likely to go for the premiership? We know Olaf Jacobson's thrown her hat in the ring, and Sir Tuke has also said that he would be seeking a fourth term.
Yes, those are the two that has made the intentions known. Definitely with Sir Tuke and Olaf, the two very strong contenders. And Tuke had 12 before. Now he could be looking at 14 if he manages to get support from some of these new members, because the three people that lost their seats were actually three of the most vocal members of parliament in the opposition. So although we don't have opposition parties, but they were opponents to the ruling government at the time. And now without those three voices, it will be interesting to see where will allegiances lie.
A shortage of Samoan coca is due to a drought that is impacting on prices and export. As a result, many Samoans say it's too expensive to buy at the moment. Sarah Vulitalitu has more.
Domestically, the price of a cocoa block is selling for almost triple the price than 2 years ago, in some cases up to 15 Samoan tala, or close to $6. The shortage of original Samoan cocoa is impacting on the marketing of a popular New Zealand brand of chocolate. Whitaker's spokesperson, Matt Whitaker, says while they have enough at the moment, the company is not heavily promoting their Koko Samoa product right now.
I think firstly, typically the Koko Samoa prices do fluctuate from crop to crop, and depending on supply and demand of the bean that goes into making the Koko Samoa. But generally speaking, the drought in 2016 has affected our supply of cocoa from Samoa, as it has affected everyone in Samoa in the cocoa industry.
Matt Whitaker says the company is assisting with a Koko Samoa pilot program aimed at improving plantation techniques, building nurseries, and ensuring the drying of beans, resulting in a sustainable product and improved quality. The Samoa cocoa plantation that Whitaker's works with on Savai Island is the Va'ai Koko Samoa family farm, which employs about 30 men. Farm co-manager Kolone Va'ai admits it is struggling to meet export demands for its organically grown product.
My cousin Sally Moore has been dealing with Whitaker's, and I guess they've managed to work out some sort of pricing system that's driving the price up, especially if we meet the standards that Whitaker's demands for their chocolate.
He says the amount of cocoa needed for export is also hard to supply when there's a drought, so a collective approach would work much better.
We've taken steps for forming an association, especially on this part of the island, called the Tua Sau Koko Association. So yeah, we've started to address those issues, especially collecting all the smaller farmers under one association or cooperative that we can try to pull everybody together to meet the supply that the markets from overseas demand.
Kolonu Va'ai says he'd like to see more locals start up their own cocoa farms. He says while it is a lucrative product, it is not easy to grow, cultivate and process. Auckland's new Kai Pasifika restaurant owner, Robert Oliver, says he got in early with his order.
It hasn't affected me yet because I'm getting my cocoa Samoa from Women in Business Development in Samoa. And 4 months ago, I gave them notice I'd need a lot. So I'm going on that supply. But they did say we need to, you know, the reason that we stocked up is because they saw the shortage coming up. So it will affect my business. I hope not too much.
He also says his umu pork dish with koko Samoa is a big hit.
People think of koko and they think of chocolate, but actually there's spices and peppery flavours and coffee flavours and bitter flavours that are really pleasing counterpoints to all the richness of all the other flavour activities going on with the dish. So that's one of our dishes that we use a lot of koko Samoa, and that's our best-selling dish, by the way.
Robert Oliver says they also use koko Samoa in desserts for their bread pudding dish and on a pavlova with mango and pawpaw. This is Sarah Ruitelatu.
A veteran Australian photojournalist says the lack of Pacific coverage in major newsrooms in Australia and New Zealand is worrying given the latest geopolitical shifts. Ben Bahana has documented conflicts in places like Bougainville, Solomon Islands, and West Papua over the last 20 years. He says while the Pacific has enjoyed relative peace and stability in recent years, it is more important than ever to keep tabs on the region. Mr. Bonner says it is worrying that the mainstream media in Australia and New Zealand are not taking an interest when independent reforms are coming up in New Caledonia and Bougainville, and countries like China and Indonesia are increasing their influence. He spoke to Karori Hawkins.
It's not just that it's our back door and our backyard, but the fact that there are so many really interesting stories. And the Pacific covers 30% of the world's surface area, so you've got all these small island states, you know, scattered across the region, but they're very strategic. They're full of people who do want to engage with the outside world and trade and have freedom of mobility. And we're also now in a new era of strategic competition where I would say the Pacific Islands have become hugely strategic again, maybe for the first time since World War II. And we're seeing very serious competition between the US and China for influence and maybe even control of the region. And I don't think we should be taking anything for granted. And so to me, it's a bit of a mystery as to why the Australian and New Zealand media aren't really looking at these big shifts, geopolitical shifts that are happening in our immediate region.
Do you think it's because of the lack of conflict, like the more mundane issues of policy and the day-to-day business of governments in the Pacific aren't as exciting as bloodshed and war?
Yes, to some extent, in that, you know, often our media responds to a crisis. So if we've had a major cyclone in Fiji or Vanuatu, or if there's a coup, or, you know, if there is conflict, obviously that will drive a little bit of media coverage. But we need to be focusing on a lot more than that. We need to be looking at a lot more of the day-to-day development issues, trade issues, looking at business, for instance, across the region, so that we've got a much more balanced picture and we don't just have media fly in, fly out in times of crisis. We actually need to be cultivating journalists in Australia and New Zealand, but also throughout the Pacific, to be able to look at the long-term issues and be able to discuss them so that we don't get superficial coverage.
It's also, unlike the Middle East and unlike Europe and the US, the area which Australia and New Zealand actually can make the biggest impact and which will have a possible impact on themselves.
Definitely. I mean, I think there's some irony that the Australian government, maybe less so the New Zealand government, but Australia often, you know, bends over backwards to support its US allies in a whole range of theatres around the world, particularly the Middle East. But the one area where we could really be making a difference to that alliance is in the way we deal with the Pacific Islands. It's the most strategic area, I would say, of the 21st century, and yet we're still putting most of our focus militarily and diplomatically on issues in the Middle East. We need to be changing that. And ironically, I think the Americans are concerned as well that Australia and New Zealand may be not doing enough to have a positive influence through the Pacific Islands.
Just looking to the future, where do you think we're heading?
I'm fairly optimistic in many ways. I think there's so much that the Pacific Islands has to offer in terms of models of sustainable living. I mean, in a way, I sometimes argue that in the 21st century, with a planet of 9 billion people and big carbon footprints, in a way, everybody in the world has to start living like a Pacific Islander, living within your means, having a garden, having a small carbon footprint. So there's many areas where the Pacific Islands can actually teach the rest of the world how to live. Equally, there's always challenges over land, over health and education issues. So there certainly are a number of big challenges for the Pacific to face and trading their way out of a dependency. I mean, the big issue that everyone's confronting in the region really is the rise of China and how the US and some of the other traditional powers of this region find a way to accommodate that and maybe work with the Chinese in a win-win situation for all the Pacific Islands. But there's equally a chance that things, you know, that strategic competition can spill over into something a little bit more hostile. So, you know, all the islands have to calibrate their relationships with their traditional partners and their new partners and hopefully find a way forward that leads to peace and prosperity for this whole region.
Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, do send us an email, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye for now.